This podcast is part of the Big Heads Media Podcast Network. Go to bigheadsmedia.com for more great podcasts.
Hi, it's Hallie.
Hi, Eeyore.
Welcome to Quiz and Hers. I have a cold.
Me
Dustin
too.
Dustin also has a cold.
This might be a slightly low energy episode if you haven't picked up on that yet.
Okay, but we will pick it up now. We're not that sick.
No, we're mostly out of the woods, I think.
Yeah, we just might sound a little funny.
Tad bit congested.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry for that sad intro.
I mean, that was a real downer.
Okay, moving on.
All right.
Now we are normal people.
I was editing the episode that came out a couple weeks ago. When this comes out recently, the one where you introduced it like a influencer DJ, I despised it in the moment, but when I was going back and listening to it, I was like, that's actually very funny.
I think it was.
So, yes, well done on that. It took me a moment to appreciate it, but yes, good stuff.
Thank you.
All right, anyway.
Anyway, as I said, my name is Hallie, and this is my husband, Justin.
Indeed.
For those of you, I did introduce the podcast, right? I think I just said this is Quiz and Hers.
I don't know if you even said that yet.
It's Quiz and Hers, woo! The trivia podcast where we test each other's knowledge and the strength of our relationship in a 10-week battle for glory.
Man, this intro has been an emotional roller coaster.
I know, right? There have been ups and downs, not in that order.
No, downs and ups.
Yes. So anyway, for those of you who are new to the podcast, the way that it works is that each week we take turns asking the other person 6 questions from 6 different categories that are tied together with a common theme. The 6 categories are times and places, arts and literature, sports and games, movies and TV, music, and everything else. And we talk a little bit about all the answers, and it's super fun. And currently, I am winning 14-12, right?
Yes. Ugh.
Pretty good. And this week, it is my turn to answer the question so I can build up even more of a lead.
Correct. Yes, so it is indeed your turn to answer the questions, meaning it is my turn to ask them. So the title of today's game is Tiger, Tiger, Quizzing Bright.
I feel like there's some reference I'm not understanding here.
Yeah, The Tiger by William Blake. Tiger, Tiger, Burning Bright in the Forest of the Night.
Nope.
Good Lord. What were you doing in your high school English class?
Reading other things?
That's a shame. So anyway, yes, the theme this week is tigers, my favorite animal for at least some period of my life during my childhood.
My favorite animal has always been a moose.
Yes, I know. You're very consistent.
I try.
I don't have a favorite animal because I'm 34 years old, and I no longer have joy in my life.
I've committed too hard to this.
That's fair.
I have a lot of stuffed animals and stuff.
You really do. You've invested a lot into this, so fair enough. All right, yes, so tigers. Question 1, sports and games. What NCAA Division I conference has no fewer than 3 teams called the Tigers?
I'm going to go with SEC.
Is that your answer?
Yeah.
It is the Southeastern
Yay!
Conference, or SEC.
Woo!
Yes, well done.
Are you impressed by me?
I am.
I'm impressed by myself.
Do you know the 3 schools?
No, I just know Clemson.
Clemson is 1.
LSU.
That's 2.
Can
she get the sweep?
I don't think so. Tell me.
Auburn.
Oh, I knew there was another.
Well, yes, because I told you there was another.
No, I knew there was like another one in like Alabama or something, but yeah. I couldn't think of it.
Yep, Auburn. All right, so the Southeastern Conference is probably the most prominent conference in college sports. It consists of 14 universities spread across the American South, with 2 more powerhouses set to join in 2024. But we'll get to that. The SEC was established in 1932 when 13 members of the old Southern Conference broke off to form their own conference. The founding members were the Alabama Crimson Tide, Auburn Tigers, Florida Gators, Georgia Bulldogs, Kentucky Wildcats, Louisiana State University Tigers, usually called LSU, the University of Mississippi Rebels, usually called Ole Miss, Mississippi State Bulldogs, Tennessee Volunteers, the Vanderbilt University Commodores, Sewanee, the University of the South Tigers, another Tigers, but they are no longer part of the conference.
We talked about, I think, the Volunteers.
You did talk about the University of Tennessee in depth, yes.
Yeah.
And they're having an excellent season right now in football.
Yeah.
Also, the Georgia Tech Yellow Jackets and the Tulane Green Wave. Sewanee left in 1940 and now plays in the Division III Southern Athletic Association. Georgia Tech left in 1964 and now plays in the ACC. And Tulane left in 1966 and now plays in the American Athletic Conference. The University of Arkansas Razorbacks and the University of South Carolina Gamecocks joined the conference in 1991. And the conference was reorganized into Eastern and Western divisions, each consisting of six schools. The SEC was the first college conference to organize itself into divisions, and the first to play a championship game between its divisions in football, which is pretty standard now in most of the major conferences.
Uh-huh.
Since 1994, the SEC championship has been held in Atlanta. The conference expanded again in 2012 with the addition of the Texas A&M Aggies and the University of Missouri Tigers, often called Mizzou.
So UT and Texas A&M play in different conferences?
For now, yes.
Weird. I thought they would be the same.
Well, they used to be and they're going to be again. So hang on. So it's Auburn, LSU, and Mizzou. So wait, who did you say that was incorrect then?
Clemson.
Oh, Clemson is ACC.
Oh.
Right, I wasn't thinking, of course. So wait, Clemson was how you got this? You thought you...
Yeah.
Oh boy.
Whatever.
Oh dear.
I was right.
Well, you got the right answer by the wrong process. If it was a math teacher, you'd get partial credit at best, but yes.
Luckily...
This is not a math class.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I always hated that. If you get the right answer, you get the right answer, you know?
Well, no, because math is all about getting it right by the right process, you know?
There have been times where I've gotten more points by getting the wrong answer
if you,
like, mess
right.
up one
yeah.
thing.
Yeah, of course. It's one thing to, you know, forget to carry the one. It's another thing to completely misunderstand long division, so...
Fair enough.
Yeah. Interestingly, Vanderbilt is the only private university in the conference, and it is by far the most academically prestigious, though Vandy's athletic teams don't usually do well against their big state school competition. Not surprisingly, they are kind of the punching bag of the SEC. In 2021, traditional rivals, the University of Texas Longhorns and the University of Oklahoma Sooners, sought to leave the Big 12 and join the SEC, and the presidents of the current 14 members voted unanimously to extend them an offer of membership. They will begin play in 2024, expanding the SEC to 16 teams, making it a true super conference. This will also, to your point, restore the traditional Texas-Texas A&M football rivalry, which has not been played much since the Aggies left the Big 12.
Which was when?
2012.
Oh, so not that long ago.
Well, yeah. By the time they start playing the SEC, it will have been 12 years since they were in the same conference.
Isn't that crazy that 2012 was 10 years ago? Sorry.
Yes, it is.
Doesn't feel like it.
No, I mean, I think it does, but...
I guess.
We've had a lot happen in those 10 years, so yes, I think it does. Hell, I mean,
true.
We've had a lot happen in the past 6 months, but...
Yep.
Anyway, today the SEC sponsors 9 men's and 12 women's sports. Not every school fields a team in every sport, but the conference requires that every member school sponsor at least 2 more women's sports than men's to balance out the large number of men's football scholarships that are awarded. This rule was actually recently adopted by the NCAA for all Division I schools, but it was
That's
pioneered
cool.
in the SEC.
Interesting.
Yeah. The SEC has a contract with CBS, giving the network first pick of the football games to show on Saturday, with the ESPN family of networks often showing other games. The conference also operates its own TV channel, the SEC Network, which launched in 2014. The SEC is generally considered to be the best conference in college football, and among the best in most other sports. According to NCAA rules, it is on equal footing with the other Power 5 conferences. Go back to Season 13, Episode 1 for more on that. But realistically, it's in a league of its own. It is just the powerhouse conference.
So wait, what conference is Clemson in?
The ACC.
ACC.
The Atlantic Coast Conference.
Oops.
Okay, question 2. Though it wasn't... I should give you the category, I guess. Everything else. So, actually not that helpful.
No.
Okay. Though it wasn't technically a tiger, the extinct marsupial known as the thylacine was often called one. What island was its native habitat before it went extinct in 1936?
I don't know.
There's a clue in there.
I feel like all marsupials are in Australia, but I also feel like you wouldn't call Australia an island. I mean, it is, but that seems like a stretch. I don't know. New Zealand.
Is that your answer?
Sure.
Boy, were you close.
Papua New Guinea.
No. If you're thinking Australia and Ireland, Tasmania. Yes.
But we already talked about the Tasmanian devils. I thought
we're talking about thylacines.
Oh, I thought that was like too similar. So no, I decided
thylacines, aka the Tasmanian tiger, aka the Tasmanian wolf.
Okay. They're very figured you already talked about the Tasmanian devil. This was too similar. I have a
penchant for bizarre Australian animals. What can I say?
Okay.
So Australia, to that point, my topic sentence here is, Australia has some weird-ass animals, especially on the isolated island of Tasmania.
Yeah.
But the thylacine might have been one of the weirdest until it went extinct. It was a carnivorous marsupial with the skull and body shape of a canid, like a wolf or a red fox, a stiff, long tail, and tiger-like stripes, but only, and this is important, only on the back half of its body.
Weird.
There are, like, extant pictures and videos of them. They are the weirdest looking fucking things you will ever see. Hal is gonna Google image search thylacine right now. It had a stiff, awkward gait, but it could also hop on its hind legs like a kangaroo.
Yeah, weird.
It's such a weird looking thing, right?
It's really weird.
Now imagine that thing up on its hind legs hopping around like a kangaroo. It's
very strange.
Terrifying. Thylacines varied in size, but they were typically about 4 feet long, not counting the 2 foot tail. And around 40 pounds. They survived long enough that black and white photos and videos still survive today, like I said, and they are very upsetting. Thylacines were often called Tasmanian tigers because of their stripes, or Tasmanian wolves because of their canine shape, but keep in mind,
they definitely look more like dogs than cats.
But they have the markings of a tiger.
Right.
On half their body, anyway. But keep in mind, they actually aren't related to cats or canines. They were marsupials, and their closest relatives are the Tasmanian devil and quolls. They had the pouches and everything.
What's a quoll?
Like a little carnivorous marsupial.
Like a quokka?
Well, those aren't carnivorous and...
They're so cute!
Anyway, they had the pouches and everything. Like, they were marsupials. They seem to have developed the skull shape and body plan of foxes or wolves through convergent evolution. Like foxes and wolves, they were nocturnal, carnivorous pack hunters, and they developed very similar adaptations. There is a persistent myth that they fed by drinking blood, but there's no good evidence of that, and frankly, it wouldn't make any sense biologically. Thylacines once inhabited mainland Australia, but they were locally extinct there well before Europeans arrived, and could only be found on Tasmania. They eventually went extinct there, too, probably due to a combination of several factors. Humans hunted them to stop them from eating livestock. Also, the introduction of dingoes meant competition for prey. And nothing was really done to try to conserve the species until it was already well in decline. The last known thylacine was a male named Benjamin who lived at Hobart Zoo. Even before his death on September 7th, 1936, it was known that Benjamin was an endling, which is a term that I had not heard until I was reading up on this. You heard this word?
Nope.
Now, an endling is the last surviving member of a species. When an endling dies, so does the species.
That's crazy.
Isn't it fascinating that we have a word for that?
Yeah. Weird.
Yeah. Even after Benjamin's death, the thylacine was not officially declared extinct for decades. The reason is that international standards require 50 years without any confirmed instances of the species in the wild. So thylacines were officially listed as endangered until the 1980s, even though everyone knew that they were almost certainly extinct in the wild. Since 1996, September 7th, the day of Benjamin's death, is commemorated in Australia as National Threatened Species Day, which I think is kind of fun.
Yeah.
There have been many reported encounters with thylacines since Benjamin's death, but none of them have ever been confirmed, and there is no reason to think that the species still exists anymore, anywhere. But that could change soon, because in August 2022, the University of Melbourne announced that they would partner with a Texas biotech company called Colossal Biosciences to try to clone thylacines and return them to the wild in Tasmania.
So, Jurassic Park.
I was going to say, I seem to recall a movie where someone did something like that, and it ended very poorly.
Yep.
Well, I'm sure this won't lead to a massive ecological disaster or anything, right?
Yeah, I mean, in Jurassic Park, they were trying to confine them, at least. If you just release this species back into the wild that hasn't existed there in almost 100 years, mm-hmm. surely things have changed, I mean.
Yeah. Yep. Our scientists were so focused on whether they could, they never stopped to think whether they should.
Yep.
Anyway, despite being extinct since the 30s, the thylacine is still a major symbol of Tasmania. Two of them appear on the Tasmanian coat of arms, and one also appears on Tasmanian license plates. There was a trilogy of platform video games in the 2000s called Tie the Tasmanian Tiger. I never played them.
I never heard of them.
Yeah. And lastly, and this is kind of fun, the thylacine is the mascot for the Tasmanian cricket team. So, along with the Toronto Raptors, I suppose, one of the few professional sports teams named for an extinct animal.
That's a fun fact.
I like that, yeah. All right, question three, arts and literature. So you have one correct answer out of two so far. Here's number three. What 2001 philosophical novel by Jan Martel has only two main characters, one of which is a Bengal tiger named Richard Parker?
The Life of Pi.
It is actually just Life of Pi. No,
whatever.
On Jeopardy, that would be counted wrong.
Life of Pi.
But I will give it to you, yes.
Thank you. Okay, so when in doubt, do not say the.
Yes, so you are allowed to drop articles like a and the. You are not allowed to add them, and you are not allowed to use the wrong one.
I will never do that again.
So always, always drop them to be safe, yes.
I will never make that mistake again.
Yeah. Little trivia strategy tip for everybody. But yes, Life of Pi.
I would be very mad at you if you said that I would not get that.
I am not risking my marriage over one definite article.
Thank you.
All right. That might be my favorite sentence I've ever said on this podcast. I'm very proud of that. Life of Pi is an odd little book. Well, not little. It's 354 pages long. But it is odd. Written by Jan Martel, I'm not actually sure, and published in 2001, it weaves together dense philosophical and religious musings with a harrowing adventure tale. The book begins with an author's note that is actually part of the novel and mostly recounts fictional events, establishing a major theme of the novel that truth is relative and nothing is, quote, objectively real.
Okay.
Yeah, you can already see we're going to go into some weird places with this one.
I think my mom read it, but I never got around to it.
Well, here's the Cliff Notes version for you.
Okay.
Following this, the book is divided into three parts, all of which are narrated by Pisin Molitor Patel, who goes by Pi. His unusual name is named after the Pisin Molitor, a famous swimming pool in France, despite the fact that neither of his parents especially liked to swim. Like I said, it's a weird book. Pi grew up in Pondicherry in India, where his father owns a zoo. In the first part of the book, he muses on names, how other kids called him Pissing, Piscine Pissing, which yes, of course they would.
Yep.
And so he chose a transcendental number as his nickname. He also mentions the time that a clerical error said that a man named Thirsty, with the surname None Given, shipped a Bengal tiger named Richard Parker to the zoo. What really happened, of course, was the man was named Richard Parker, and he named the tiger Thirsty, and someone mixed up the names on the paperwork.
What a weird name for a tiger.
Pi's father finds this so funny that they continue to call the tiger Richard Parker, so that's why it has this bizarre name.
Uh-huh.
It's a clerical error.
I think it's better than Thirsty.
Yeah, apparently, like, the guy who first found the tiger when he was a cub, he named him Thirsty because he was, like, just lapping up all this water from a stream when he rescued him.
Okay.
Anyway, Pi was raised Hindu, but he also studies Christianity and Islam and takes on teachings from all three religions, saying that he, quote, just wants to love God. In 1976, during a time of upheaval in India, Pi's father sells the zoo and the family prepares to immigrate to Canada. Part two of the book tells the story of how the Japanese freighter that was transporting the family and their animals sinks, and Pi finds himself stranded on a lifeboat in the middle of the Pacific Ocean with Richard Parker, who, again, is a 450-pound feral Bengal tiger. Not feral, but he's mostly been raised in captivity, but still, like, it's a fucking wild animal, fucking 450 pounds of claws, stripes, and murder.
Right.
Pi uses food as a reinforcer and seasickness as a punishment to train Richard to take on a submissive role, and the tiger eventually accepts Pi as the alpha. They are adrift for 227 days before washing ashore in Mexico. Despite the bond they have formed, Richard Parker immediately runs into the jungle without so much as a second glance, leaving Pi heartbroken. So Pi was, like, kind of imputing all these human emotions onto him, like, oh, you know, we're alone together in the world, we're friends, like, we cooperate, we work together. as soon as the tiger saw land, it was just like, fuck off, I'm out of here.
He's just a tiger.
Well, that's exactly it, right? And I guess that's part of the point is like, animal's gonna animal, right? Like, we are different from them in that way, that we have these connections and these emotions. And
like, it probably got him through this whole trip to feel like he had a connection.
Right, and in the end, it's nothing to the tiger.
Right.
Which, that's pretty funny, I think. In part three, Pi converses with officials from the Japanese Ministry of Transport who are investigating the shipwreck. They don't believe his story, so he tells them an alternative tiger-free version. He points out that neither story can be proven and neither one will help to explain the shipwreck, so the men can choose which one they prefer. They choose to file a report that includes the 450-pound carnivorous beast, and Pi replies, "And so it goes with God." Meaning that even if you can't prove God's existence, you might as well choose the better story that includes him.
Uh-huh.
The novel's major themes are the subjectivity of truth and the sustaining power of faith in trying times. The book was rejected by 5 publishers before being accepted by Knopf Canada. It then proceeded to win the Man Booker Prize for Fiction.
Wow.
So, good job, those other 5 publishers.
Yeah.
Martell has said that he chose the name Richard Parker because it appears in no fewer than 3 other prominent shipwreck narratives. Edgar Allan Poe's novel, The Narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym of Nantucket, the real-life legal case of R.V. Dudley and Stevens, and a non-fiction account of the sinking of the Francis Speight written by Jack London. In all 3 instances, the Richards Parker end up dead and cannibalized.
Wow.
Bizarre.
Yeah.
As I'm sure you know, the book was adapted into a 2012 feature film directed by Ang Lee. It stars Suraj Sharma as Pi and a lot of CGI as Richard Parker and the ocean. It was critically well-received, and Martell himself has expressed satisfaction with the film, which I feel that's kind of unusual for an author to actually go like, yeah, good job, Hollywood. Like, that never happens.
No.
It was nominated for 11 Academy Awards, winning 4. Best Visual Effects, Best Original Score, Best Cinematography, and Best Director for Lee. The book has also twice been adapted as a play, oddly enough, which I feel like that doesn't really work. You need a convincing tiger on stage.
Yeah, it's weird.
Hard to imagine that, but anyway.
Kind of like Equus.
Don't they actually have a real horse on stage, though?
What, do they have a stuffed tiger?
Well, they can't have a real tiger.
Okay, but like, no, an Equus, isn't it like a person in a horse? No?
Is it?
I don't know.
Maybe it's just the poster that has a real horse.
I'm not sure.
I don't know, I'm...
Well, Warhorse, that's like, that was like a mechanical looking
horse. Yeah. I don't know. I'm just remembering that, like, creepy... Maybe that was for the movie version. Was there a movie version of Equus? No, right? I'm just remembering that creepy poster with Daniel Radcliffe looking like he wants to fuck that horse real bad. And that was a real horse, but maybe it's just the poster.
Yeah,
maybe
they don't
actually have an actual horse on stage. That does seem crazy.
I guess we could talk about Equus sometime.
Yeah, that seems weird and interesting. Yeah, sure, why not? Add it to your list.
Okay.
How have you not done a game themed around horses? That seems impossible.
Yeah, I know. Nah, I'll do it.
All right.
I can't do it soon because you just are doing tigers now, so.
Right, maybe next season.
Okay.
All right.
All right, that brings us to halftime. Thank you for listening. We love that you listen. I just feel like we say we appreciate it every single time.
No, that's fair. Trying to shake it up, I like that.
Yeah. And you can like us on social media, you can subscribe, you can leave a rating and or review.
Please do those things.
Do it all. And just a reminder, we are on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Quiz and Hers. And we also have an email address, which is quizandhers@gmail.com. And you can reach out to us through any of those means.
Correct.
Send us a fact or fucked. That would be cool.
Please do.
I guess that's it. We're proud members of the Big Heads Media Podcast Network. I have no other way of saying that. Sorry.
It's been a little while since we've recorded.
Yes.
Because we were moving and then traveling. We're recording actually in our new house now, the first house we've ever had, which is pretty cool.
Also, I'm very pregnant and that's an excuse for anything.
Well, yeah, but anyway, it's been a few weeks, so Hallie's a little rusty.
Yes.
As you can tell.
It's okay.
All right.
Anyway, what was I saying? Big Heads Media Podcast Network.
Big Heads.
You can go to bigheadsmedia.com and check out our merch and other cool podcasts, and they're about all different kinds of things, and check those out. And we're going to hear an ad from one of them right now.
Hey guys, this is Venice, and I've got a message from a friend of mine about my favorite podcast.
It's your boy, Flavor Flav, in full effect. Check this out, everybody. I want y'all to go check out TJ.
What's good, everybody? TJ Johnson here for Voice from the Underground. I am the most handsome.
Big ass.
And I'm smoking my cigar, of course.
You know what I'm saying? And Josh.
You pick me up in an Uber and a PT Cruiser, I'm calling Lyft.
They be fighting the power, talking about social issues, politics, you know what I'm saying?
And we're not even that good.
Right, we're terrible. Terrible. Tangents all over the place.
And not only that, but they be keeping the fun with the sports, music, comics, and movies too.
Am I allowed to talk?
I think, no, not right now.
Shut up, colonizer!
You know what I'm saying? He on Twitter at VFU Podcast. Yo, you can find him. You can find him. So check 1, 2. This is Flavor Flav. Yeah, boy.
Okay. What Flav was trying to say is check out Voice from the Underground on your favorite podcast network.
Voice from the Underground.
Okay, we are back.
All right. Onward to question 4, movies and TV. What 1980s science fantasy cartoon series had a humanoid tiger character named Tigra, who was Lion-O's second in command? You might be just a shade too young to remember this.
I don't know. I know Voltron had something to maybe do with lions. I don't know. Let's go with that. Voltron. It's definitely not. I just know something about lions.
In Voltron, the lions were like the mecha machines that they piloted. They were not like humanoid lion.
Oh, I don't
people.
Know.
They were piloted by humans, not like cat people.
I see. I don't know.
This is Thundercats.
Oh, I have heard of that.
Yes, you have. And now you will know everything there is to know about it. Thundercats was a very 80s kids show. It was produced from 1985 to 1989 by Rankin-Bass Animated Entertainment, who I believe you've spoken about at length.
Yep.
And Leisure Concepts, later known as 4Kids Entertainment, who were responsible for a very good portion of my childhood. It only ever aired in syndication, so when and if it was on depended on where you lived, and reruns continued to air for years after production ended. It follows the adventures of the titular Thundercats, who are cat-like humanoid aliens who fled their dying homeworld of Thundera and landed on a new planet called Third Earth. The series is notable for its blend of magic and sci-fi technology, and its tendency for episodes to end with a very on-the-nose conversation about how some moral virtue saved the day. So it was always like, we only made it through because we were loyal to each other, or, you know, we won the day today because we showed compassion. Like, it was always like that. And
yeah.
Even as a kid, like, I liked this show
very
a lot.
80s.
It was so 80s. Like, I liked the show when I was young. I was watching the syndicated reruns, of course, but, like, I always enjoyed the first 29 minutes of an episode, and then that last bit, even I was just like, oh, come on, that's a little much. But anyway. The main character is Lion-O, who, as you may have guessed, resembles a lion. He was only about 12 years old when Thundera died, but due to a malfunction in his suspended animation capsule, he has aged 10 years by the time the Thundercats arrive on Third Earth, making him essentially a child in an adult's body. So this is kind of how they made the main character a big, strong, powerful-looking adult lion-human monster, but still relatable to the kids.
Uh-huh.
That was sort of the way they got around it.
At least they tried to actually come up with a reason instead of just being like, this is how it is.
He's just an immature dipshit, right? Yeah, that's fair. His royal heritage makes him the Lord of the Thundercats, and he matures over the course of the series into an effective leader. So again, it's like trying to teach the kids, you know, learn what Lion-O is learning and learn these, you know, these moral messages that Lion-O is learning through his adventures. Lion-O wields the legendary Sword of Omens, which holds the Eye of Thundera, a mystical object that allows him to see events that are taking place elsewhere, an ability called Sight Beyond Sight. So whenever you hear, like, give me Sight Beyond Sight, that's a Thundercats reference.
Okay.
Also, I'm just going to digress here a little bit. That ability seems just ripe for abuse, but they never touch on that. I mean, if you gave a 12-year-old boy, essentially, who was trapped in the body of a fully adult man, the ability to see what was going on anywhere in the world, let's just say I think he'd be peeping on Chitara in the shower a lot more than they showed in the show.
Is that the Cheeto one?
We're getting to her, but yes, okay. She was the hot Cheetah.
I love hot Cheetos.
They're better than regular Cheetos, I'll give you that. Jesus. The other Thundercats are Tigra, Lion-O's second in command, Panthro, Chitara, and the twin Thunder Kittens, Wily Kit and Wily Cat. Both of them are based on Wildcats, with Wily Cat being a few minutes older than his twin sister, Wily Kit. There's also the incredibly obnoxious creature called Snarf, but the less that is said about him, the better. We all hated Snarf.
Okay.
Three more survivors of the Death of Thundera were introduced later. Bengali, who resembles a white Bengal tiger, Lynxo, and Pumira. You can probably figure out what they are. The primary antagonist of the show is the mummified sorcerer Mum-Ra, who allies with the Thundercats' traditional enemies, the mutants of Plundar, to defeat them. Though various other enemies were introduced over the course of the series, including the Lunataks and Mum-Ra's superiors, the Ancient Spirits of Evil. And I remember the Ancient Spirits of Evil because I was watching these totally out of order. So, like, sometimes I'd see, like, a season 5 episode where Mum-Ra was just, like, this cowering little piece of shit, like, answering to these other guys. And then I'd see a season 1 episode where he's just this menacing demon monster of a man.
And then it turns out he's not that crazy.
Yeah, it turns out he's just like a drone, like following orders, basically. It was very confusing. There was a TV movie released in 1986 that bridged between seasons 1 and 2 called Thundercats Ho, which was also Lion-O's catchphrase.
Okay.
Ho! You've seen this.
I have not.
Well, you've certainly seen like memes about Thundercats Ho! No? Nothing?
I don't know.
All right. The original series ran for 4 seasons and a total of 130 episodes. And it has been rebooted twice, once in 2011 with the joint Japanese-American series Thundercats, and again in 2022 with Thundercats Roar. These each only ran for one season of 26 and 52 episodes, respectively. A CGI animated feature film based on the series was announced in 2007, but it has been stuck in development hell ever since, and it will probably never get made. Which is probably for the best, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, who wants a Thundercats movie? All right. Question 5, times and places. You have 2 correct answers of 4. You have 2 correct answers out of 4 right now, I think?
Yeah.
Okay. Times and places. The Tamil Tigers were a revolutionary group active from 1976 to 2009 in what island nation?
Tamil.
Tamil, yes.
That sounds so familiar.
It should.
Ugh. Sri Lanka.
Is that your answer?
Yeah.
It's Sri Lanka.
Oh, yay, I did it.
Yes, nicely done.
Thank you.
So, Sri Lanka is an island nation in the Indian Ocean, located to the southwest of India. It is often called the Teardrop of India for its distinctive shape. Its executive and judicial capital is Colombo, while its official and legislative capital is the unpronounceable Sri Jayawardena Parakota, which is...
We were just talking about this.
Yes, I know. It just came up the other day. Yeah, it's basically a suburb of Colombo anyway, and locals usually just call it Kot. So, which makes sense, because...
Yeah.
Again, just impossible to say. Sri Lanka has been inhabited for at least 125,000 years, and perhaps as long as 500,000 years. One of the earliest written references to the island is in the Indian epic the Ramayana, which I think you've spoken about.
Yeah.
The island's history traditionally begins in 453 BC, when the semi-legendary Prince Vijaya brought 700 followers to Sri Lanka after being expelled from the Vanga kingdom in modern-day Bengal. He is considered to be the first monarch of Sri Lanka, according to the Mahavamsa, which is a meticulously recorded historical epic poem in the Pali language. It's kind of the, like, national epic of Sri Lanka, but it's also just, like, a long, tedious record of all the kings.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. The Anuradhapura kingdom was established in 377 BC and lasted well over 1,000 years to 1017 AD. Buddhism came to the island around 250 BC and quickly spread through the Sinhalese population, which was and is the majority ethnic group. So the Sinhalese are the dominant ethnic group there. In 245 BC, a cutting from the Bodhi tree under which the Buddha became enlightened was planted, and it is considered the oldest human-planted tree in the world. It's still there.
That's cool.
Amazing, right? I mean, hard to know for sure that it's actually from the tree that the Buddha sat under, but that's what tradition says, and it is, like, old enough that it could be. The Anuradhapura Kingdom was also the first Southeast Asian polity to have a female ruler. Queen Anula ruled from 47 BC to 42 BC. The Anuradhapura Kingdom fell in 1017 to an invasion by the Chola Empire, an ethnically Tamil polity from southern India. Vijayabahu I drove out the Cholas in 1070, unifying the island again. Sri Lanka reached the peak of its power under Parakramabahu I, who ruled from 1153 to 1186. Sri Lanka declined after his death, and it was devastated in 1215 when Kalinga Maga invaded. It's not clear where exactly this guy came from, but he looted and wrecked absolutely everything in his path, and he established the Jaffna Kingdom on the northern side of the island. The Portuguese arrived in 1505 and built a fort at the port city of Colombo. They eventually came to control most of the coastal areas, and, oh boy, here we go, Vimala Dharmasaruriya I, who ruled the native southern kingdom, moved his capital inland to Kandy, K-A-N-D-Y. Kandy would end up being the last independent monarchy of Sri Lanka. In 1595, that guy I said a minute ago who brought the... What?
Lazy.
I am not making a second attempt at that one. In 1595, that guy I said a minute ago brought the relic of the Tooth of Buddha, supposedly the left canine tooth of the Buddha himself, to Kandy, where he built the famous Temple of the Tooth. So that's like a relatively well-known landmark in Sri Lanka.
I'll have to go.
Oh, for sure. If we're ever in Sri Lanka, we have to see the Temple of the Tooth.
Yeah.
In 1619, the Portuguese conquered the Jaffna Kingdom in the north, but the Kingdom of Kandy endured, at least for a while longer. In 1683, King Rajasinha II signed a treaty with the Dutch East India Company to expel the Portuguese. The ensuing Dutch-Portuguese War ended in a Dutch victory, and the Dutch immediately reneged on the deal and occupied the territories that Portugal had controlled. So they basically promised the Kingdom of Kandy, yeah, we'll get rid of your Portuguese problem, and then you can have your land back if you trade with us. And they were just like, nah, I think we'll just keep it after all, because we're the Dutch. They controlled the coastal areas until the Napoleonic Wars, when the British conquered the island to prevent it from falling to France. The Brits called the island Ceylon, a name it would have for almost 200 years. Kandy was occupied by the British in 1815, finally ending the last independent Sri Lankan monarchy. Ceylon became an independent dominion in 1948 with the promulgation of the so-called Solberry Constitution. It became a republic in 1972, returning to the historical name Sri Lanka. Since then, Sri Lankan history has been dominated by a protracted civil war between the Sinhalese majority and the largest minority group, the Tamils. The war began in 1983 and was fought between the Sri Lankan military and the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam, usually called the Tamil Tigers, until the Tigers were defeated in 2009. Since then, the country has enjoyed relative peace, though the economy imploded in 2019, largely because of a foolish law outlawing the use of artificial pesticides in agriculture. Basically, Sri Lanka wanted to become the first all-organic nation in the world.
And it ruined their whole economy?
Yes, well, you see, the problem is that organic farming is expensive and has lower crop yields than conventional farming. So food shortages and rampant inflation predictably ensued.
Oy.
And, like, basically all the scientists and all the economists were saying, like, do not pass this law. Like, you are going to burn your economy to the ground. And they're like, nope, organic. Organic is good.
Which, a lot of things are good.
I know some people like that. Anyway. On July 9th, 2022, protesters stormed the president's house in Colombo, forcing President Gotabaya Rajapaksa to flee to Singapore. He resigned, and Prime Minister Ranil Wickremesinghe became the acting president. He was elected as Sri Lanka's ninth president to finish out Rajapaksa's term in a special election in the parliament. He remains deeply unpopular with the people, as he was one of the primary architects of the failed economic policies that got the country into this mess. So we'll see what happens next. So basically, like, according to the Constitution, if the president resigns, there's not a general election. The parliament elects the next president. And so they just said, prime minister guy, go do it. But, like, the public hates him almost as much as they hate the former president because he was also one of the main architects of this disastrous economic policy. So we'll see. Unrest continues as of now.
We've had a lot of discussions leading up to now, like current events.
Yeah, we have recently, haven't we?
Oh, Bolsonaro lost.
Oh, yeah, he did. That's right. We were going to see what happened with that.
Yep. Yeah, but then I hear there are protests, so who knows what's going to happen.
Well, of course. There's always protests when elections are that close. All right, question 6 is music. What hip-hop collective that ain't nothing to fuck with opens the song that tells us that with a voiceover saying, Tiger Style. Tiger Style. You heard me.
Wu-Tang Clan. I don't know.
How the fuck did you do that?
It just felt right.
Yes, it's Wu-Tang Clan.
Amy!
God damn.
I couldn't get there at first. I was like, I know what I'm thinking this is, but I can't think of the name.
Wu-Tang Clan ain't nothing to fuck with.
Pregnancy brain can suck it. Justin just keeps getting annoyed with me because I can't remember anything.
No, you're definitely not functioning at 100% right now, but that's all right.
Which makes this even more impressive.
It is. So Wu-Tang Clan are one of the most important and influential hip-hop groups in history. The group was formed in the early 90s by 8 East Coast rappers. Cousins Robert Diggs, a.k.a. RZA, Gary Grice, a.k.a. GZA, and Russell Jones, a.k.a. Old Dirty Bastard. Amazing. Okay. Along with Jason Hunter, a.k.a. Inspecta Deck, Lamont Hawkins, a.k.a. U-God, Dennis Coles, a.k.a. Ghostface Killa, Corey Woods.
I've heard of Ghostface Killa.
Yeah. Corey Woods, a.k.a. Raekwon, and Clifford Smith Jr., a.k.a. Method Man, who is arguably the most famous member on his own. Though
this is too many names to remember.
Though they're all super influential. Well, so it's RZA, GZA, Old Dirty Bastard, Inspecta Deck, U-God, Ghostface Killa, Raekwon, and Method Man. They wanted to form a hip-hop collective inspired by Eastern philosophy by way of kung fu movies, combined with black nationalism and comic books. They took the name Wu-Tang Clan from the 1983 Hong Kong martial arts film Shaolin and Wu-Tang, about the rivalry between two kung fu schools. Their debut single, Protect Ya Neck, was released independently in 1993, and it gained them a substantial following in the underground hip-hop scene. Following its release, they were joined by Jamel Arif, aka Masta Killa. Their first album, Enter the Wu-Tang, parentheses 36 Chambers, was released in November 1993, and it is considered a stone-cold classic. In addition to Protect Ya Neck, it includes classic tracks like Bring Da Ruckus, Wu-Tang Clan Ain't Nothing to Fuck With, Can It All Be So Simple, and C-R-E-A-M. Following Enter the Wu-Tang, many of the members released solo albums. The plan was always that they would have their own careers in addition to their Wu work. They reassembled in 1990.
Wu work.
Yeah, well, they do sometimes just refer to it as Wu, like when they're together as the Wu-Tang Clan.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. They reassembled in 1997 and released Wu-Tang Forever, which is probably best known for the track Triumph, featuring longtime Wu-Tang collaborator and later official member Daryl Hill, a.k.a. Capadonna. Their third album, The W, was released in 2001 and featured the well-known single Gravel Pit. Despite being in jail at the time, ODB, that's Old Dirty Bastard, they sometimes call him ODB. Despite being in jail at the time, ODB contributed lyrics that were literally phoned in. Like, he recorded them
from a jail phone.
Over the phone from prison.
Amazing.
Incredible. That is dedication to your craft. They released Iron Flag in 2001. ODB tragically died in the studio on November 13th, 2004. So they were working on their next album and then
just after he got out of prison.
Well, no, he was out in time for Iron Flag, but okay. Then, yeah, he just dropped dead in the studio.
Oy.
Not really clear what happened. This didn't stop the Clan, and they released 8 Diagrams in 2007, which was the first album to include Capadonna as an official member, and they released A Better Tomorrow in 2011. All of those first 6 albums were produced by RZA, usually with the help of producer Ronald Bean, better known as Mathematics, who also happens to be the one who designed Wu-Tang's iconic W logo. So he's not, like, part of the group, but he's produced most of their albums, along with RZA, and he designed their awesome logo.
Uh-huh.
In March 2014, it was revealed that the Clan had been secretly recording tracks for another album for the past 6 years. Once Upon a Time in Shaolin has such an odd story, it could be its own discussion. So here we go. It was primarily produced by Tariq Azogar, better known as Silva Rings, making it the first Wu-Tang studio album on which RZA was not the primary producer. RZA saw the rise of streaming and online piracy as having devalued music, and he took inspiration for the album from Renaissance art patronage. The idea was to create an album that would be a unique piece of fine art, and when I say unique, I mean it. Only one copy of the double CD was ever produced, and it resides in an ornate, one-of-a-kind metal box. It was auctioned off on the high-end online auction site Paddle 8 in 2015 to an unknown buyer.
Wow.
It has since been discovered that it was sold for $2 million to Turing Pharmaceuticals CEO Martin Shkreli, who you may remember as the pharma bro, quote-unquote, who drastically increased the price of the drug Daraprim and was later arrested and jailed for securities fraud.
Yeah.
After his arrest, the album, again, the only copy of the album, was seized and resold by the government. It is now known that it was sold by the government in 2021 for $4 million to Pleaser DAO, a group that mostly collects NFTs.
So now it's an NFT?
No, it's not. But this collective, this weird semi-anonymous online group, now owns the only copy of this album.
Better than Martin Shkreli,
I guess. So, anyone who purchases the album, including this group, must agree to a contract stipulating that it cannot be exhibited for profit for 88 years, which RZA says was done to prevent accusations that the sole release was just a publicity stunt. Once Upon a Time in Shaolin has been certified by the Guinness Book of World Records as the most valuable album in the world.
That's cool.
Yeah. In addition to their own works, the Wu-Tang Clan have launched the careers of way too many other artists to name. Their protégés are collectively known as the Wu-Tang Killer Bees. About.com and Rolling Stone both rank the Wu-Tang Clan as the greatest hip-hop group of all time, and I can't say that I disagree.
What is Method Man known for? I'm trying to remember, but I can't. Like, individually?
I mean, a lot of stuff. He's the one that's probably the most, like, well-known within the mainstream of all of them.
Yeah.
Although Ghostface Killah and Raekwon have also carved out followings, but, like, he's the one that, like, non-hip-hop fans have heard of.
Yep.
Hey, everyone. We will be back to our regularly scheduled episode of Quiz and Hers in just one moment. But first, we want to take a moment to recommend another great trivia podcast we think you might enjoy. If you're liking what we're doing here, you should check out the Brain Ladle podcast. That's Brain, L-A-D-L-E, because I can never remember how to spell that kitchen tool. They are just a bunch of guys who quiz each other every week. Every quiz has a theme, sort of like ours, but they do 24 questions and a 10-answer final bonus round at the end. So a lot more questions and a lot less dicking around than on our show. So
less talking, more questioning.
Correct, yes. But it's a real fun show, and if you enjoy what we're doing here, definitely go check them out on wherever you get your podcasts. That's Brain Ladle Podcast.
Enjoy. Okay, that brings us to our final segment of the show, Fact or Fucked.
Indeed it does.
This Fact or Fucked comes from our fan and friend, Peter T.
Thanks, Peter.
Thank you. Thank you for sending us stuff.
A frequent contributor to this segment, and yes, we very much appreciate it.
We do. And he said, the Sun Life office building in downtown Montreal was the global headquarters for the company's insurance business until the 1980s. It included a shooting range on a floor between the official 16th and 17th floors.
Okay. So it's a two-parter. First part is not the interesting part. I'm going to assume that's real. Would an insurance company have a shooting range? I mean, seems like you'd need quite a high amount of insurance if you're going to have a shooting range in your office building. But somewhere in the back of my brain, I feel like I've heard this. I'm going to say fact.
Actually, it was between the 14th and the 15th. No, I'm kidding.
Oh, get fucked.
I'm kidding. Yeah, it's fact. And Peter was even kind enough to send us more details. He said that the building has a shooting range on floor 16A, and he actually worked as an actuary in the building.
No.
Yeah, from 1977 to 1980. And at that time, the elevator still had a button for 16A between the buttons for 16 and 17, but it was non-operational.
Meaning he didn't have the secret key that would unlock it so he could go to the shooting range?
Or it no longer, like, it was just existed? No longer
used?
Yeah. That's not entirely clear to me.
That is.
But we could look it up.
Why a shooting range? I don't know. Like, why is that the thing that they tucked away? Like, why not? I don't know. Like, if you're an insurance company with a bunch of, like, you know, rich CEO types coming in and out, like, why not a high-end secret steakhouse hidden between two of your floors? Or, like, a fucking, I don't know, like a Turkish bath or something? Why a shooting range, of all things? It's so odd. I don't know. I guess I'm not, like, a gun guy, I guess, so I don't really get that appeal, but all right, cool, whatever.
Oh, I just went to the website, he said. There was a hospital on the 8th floor, a bowling
just
alley.
Just in case of a shooting accident?
I guess. A bowling alley on the 10th floor. A gym on the 7th floor. That's less weird.
Right. But all of this was, like, official and publicly known.
Yeah.
That's so weird.
And the shooting range. Yeah. On floor 16A.
Very odd.
Yep.
All right. Well, that's a fun one. Thank you, Peter.
Yes, thank you.
Very strange, but very cool that it had a personal connection for him.
Yeah.
And if you want to have a little shout out on the show like Peter just did, send us your submissions for Factor Fucked, either your favorite weird true facts like that, or your favorite made-up non-facts that you think you can fool us into thinking are true. And whichever one you send, of course, we will give you a little shout out to thank you for contributing to the show.
Thank you. We will see you next week.
Yeah, I guess that's it. So
I am winning.
Did you get 4?
Yes.
Fucking hell. You're up 18 to 12.
Wu-Tang, baby.
Wu-Tang is forever, and I am... Hallie's trying to do the Wu-Tang sign, but she doesn't know how. It's like this.
Oh, it is just this. Okay.
I am in serious trouble as this season comes to its conclusion.
Yeah, well,
soon.
Last season you did so well that the last episode was meaningless, so...
That's true. Well, hopefully that won't happen this time. Hopefully I at least have a chance by the end of the season. We'll see. All right, come back next week and see if I can close this gap.
Yep.
All right, see you then. Bye.
Bye. You're insane.
What? That was very funny. Come on.
It was.
All right, just for posterity, so I know this when I'm editing this.
Now that it's sinking in, it's very good.
Allie was talking to the unborn baby and said, "Come on, man, don't you want to sleep every once in a while?" And I responded, "No, he'll sleep when he's alive." And she's just now figuring out why that was funny.
I'm not just figuring out why it was funny, it's just growing on me.
All right.